Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of February 4th. We're back on our weekly schedule this week, and we're joined by James Keene, associate editor of the magazine, who's going to be talking about his article for this week's issue called Vocation and Crisis, Entering Religious Life During a Time of Scandal. Jim, perhaps you can tell our listeners a little bit about how you got the idea for this article.
Well, one of the other editors told me that Vocation and Crisis is a much better title than Vocation in Crisis. But that's neither here nor there. Actually, it comes from kind of an unlikely source. My thesis director at Columbia, though he wasn't much of a religious person himself, would always encourage me to look for the specific angle on a story or a situation that I could bring as an individual writer. I was getting my MFA there and working a lot with him on areas in which my perspective would be a unique one. And he would often say that in the mainstream media and even in more niche markets, there were certain voices that were heard and certain ones that weren't. From that, I kind of noticed over time that the point of view of a seminarian is not really often addressed in articles about sex abuse and coverage of the sex abuse crisis, or even in coverage of the church in general. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, in a lot of seminaries and for a lot of seminarians, the dominant culture is one where you keep your head down, for obvious reasons. A long course of training, and there's any number of people who may or may not like what you have to say. Also, second, seminarians tend not to be in the public eye as much as a priest, as much as a layperson who is working actively in the church. They tend to be hidden away a little more often. And so that point of view, I thought, really wasn't being represented as much as it could be.
So you decided to write about something that is really quite interesting, which is you decided on your vocation right around the time of the sexual abuse crisis, and a time, you know, which was tumultuous for many Catholics, and you would think especially for those who had decided to give their life to the church. What was that like? I mean, maybe you can lead us through when exactly you first decided to join the order and when you first started hearing of the revelations.
Yes. Well, you know, I was talking the other day with a friend. He reminded me of what he had said at the time is we were both fans of the band The Jayhawks, and they have a great song called You Picked a Bad Time to Be in Love.
It's a great song. I know that song.
Actually, I think it's a cover. It's not really The Jayhawks, but they have a good version of it. In any case, I actually had first started thinking seriously about the Jesuits in around the fall of 2001. The vocation came on kind of suddenly and much stronger over the next couple months. And starting in around January of that year is when I really contacted the vocations director to get an application to start talking with him about the process of applying to the California province where I was living at the time. I was living in Los Angeles. And around that same time is when the Boston Globe really sort of broke the sex abuse scandal nationally. There had been a number of books and articles over the years about it, but that coverage really turned it into a nationwide event. And in California, the big stories started to come around the same time, January, February, March, April of 2002. So the two processes were kind of running concurrently. So as I was growing more and more interested in this idea that God might be calling me to the church as a priest, at the same time, everywhere you turned, there were stories about priestly scandals. So it was an interesting contradiction there.
And it wasn't that, I mean, a lot of the stories that were coming out were from an earlier time, you know, were from the 90s or before. Yet, as you say in the article, there were people you knew who had been accused, and there were some Jesuits or Jesuit institutions that were facing some difficult allegations. So it wasn't like this was a distant reality for you. It was fairly hit close to home.
Oh, sure. A parish priest who I had known well, who I was an altar boy for, who I once went on a hiking trip with. He took a big group of us out. He was accused and is still actually facing allegations. A high school teacher who, again, I was very close with. He was a good friend, a good mentor, also was accused, though he has actually never been charged. And over the years, a number of people that my, you know, if you come from a big Catholic family like I do, and you're an altar boy, your parents are Eucharistic ministers, your siblings are altar boys and altar girls, you tend just to spend a lot of time around clergy and religious. I think it's impossible to be part of that culture and not know someone who has been accused.
Now, did this make you think more deeply about your vocation? It really challenged you in a way to perhaps, I mean, you really had to be serious about this because you were entering the church at a difficult time.
I think probably anyone who has a vocation thinks that they are thinking about it more seriously than anyone else on earth because it can be like any big decision in life, momentous. And then you have the added, you also have to make the decision that to say to the public, I think God is calling me to this, which is a very different thing than saying to someone, I'm switching jobs, or, you know, even saying to someone necessarily that you're moving somewhere new or anything like that. So it requires a great deal of humility, but also a certain amount of arrogance to make the public statement to your family and friends, by the way, God is calling me to be a priest.
Now, what did your family and friends think of this decision in light of the what was going on in the church?
Well, my parents were very supportive. They were the first to find out. And then after that, I didn't really tell my siblings until I did get in. And they were supportive. You know, one of my sisters did bring up an interesting point, is that in institutions where all the power tends to be centralized with just men, there can be an ability there to ignore other voices, and that in addition to just the fact that there are people who have sexual problems, there can be a culture that actually protects and perpetuates it just by not being necessarily open to other voices.
Yeah, no, that's a challenge, and that's something this church is still dealing with. Now, in this story, you tell some interesting anecdotes about what it was like when you were finally wearing a collar during the time of the sex abuse crisis. One little anecdote here, you were in an Italian restaurant with your family. Why don't you tell that story?
Yes, this is the night before the wedding of a sister, and we were basically having the rehearsal dinner. So we had taken up a couple tables. It was a big group. We were having a great time. This would have been 2003, the summer, and I was playing with a lot of my nieces and nephews on the floor of the restaurant. They kind of had a little dance floor. At one point, when I was playing with them, I looked up and I realized that there were a lot of people in that restaurant who were staring at me. And, you know, it's easy to think that maybe I'm imagining this, maybe I'm just a little paranoid about this, but I really did get the impression a lot of people were looking at this young guy in a Roman collar, wondering why he's playing with all these little kids. And that's, I think, a significant shift in the way a priest or a seminarian is perceived in popular culture. Because I think the image of a young man in a Roman collar playing with children brings to mind much different images now than it would have necessarily 20 years ago.
Sure. No, it definitely does. And I mean, you remember reading at the time of this scandal of priests who were embarrassed walking down the street with their collar. They certainly felt like they were being stared at. And now let's double back to the time when you were exploring your vocation and you started meeting Jesuits. Now, how were they, older Jesuits, how were they handling this as it was going on?
Well, I think you get different reactions across the board. I certainly remember in those days knowing some priests who said this is being blown out of proportion, knowing others saying that, you know, this is a serious crack in the foundation, and knowing a lot who were just dealing with personal anguish over the way not only their own reputations, but the reputations of their friends were being damaged, and in some cases seeing friends that they knew and trusted turn out to actually be accused, and in some cases guilty. And so I think there was a lot of private anguish that you would only hear in certain circumstances. One of the most moving moments for me of that year was going to Holy Thursday Mass and seeing the priest, a Jesuit I knew, washing the feet of 12 people who had come up to stand in for the disciples and actually crying while he was doing it. I think the day before or that day, there had been an awful story in the paper about sex abuse. So I think there was a lot of anger both at the church and at the way the church was being represented and at the people who had done this.
Now, in the article you write about when you first visited the novitiate in California, and you right in the midst of the sex abuse crisis, and you looked at your fellow Jesuits. Now, how were they dealing with it at the time?
Well, I was very surprised, actually. I think if you're visiting a place like a novitiate or a seminary as an outsider, you really have no idea what's going on there because you have your own life that is a very different world. And so I was surprised that it wasn't a bigger topic of conversation and discussion. I mean, it certainly came up. I was there for 4 days visiting, and so certainly it came up. But I was surprised that their main focus wasn't the same. I was working as a freelance writer at the time. I was reading a lot of different newspapers and magazines, and it seemed to me that this would be topic A of conversation at every meal, at every gathering. But it really wasn't, and I was taken aback by that. And it wasn't until a little bit later that I realized that they had, you know, other issues to on their minds in those days. Is they were discerning their own vocations. It was a very prayerful, hardworking, tranquil place, one where, to a certain extent, some of the information from the outside world was filtered, but also to a certain extent where there was a difference in priorities from my own life that I didn't recognize until I saw that change.
Now, the sexual abuse scandal was 6 years ago, 2002, we're in 2008 now. Looking back over that time, what do you think that experience has sort of taught you about yourself and your own vocation?
I would say certainly the number one lesson for me over those years has been, in terms of my own vocation and other people's vocations, is that vocation is a very singular thing, that the external situation is very rarely the number one factor in determining an internal reality. And if a person feels called by God to religious life or the priesthood, what's going on in the church is obviously going to affect their decision, but it's not going to make the decision for them. Because essentially the decision to enter the religious life or the priesthood is one that depends on one personal relationship with God, and feeling that God is calling you to a religious vocation doesn't necessarily depend on the situation of the church around you, for better or for worse.
Now, at the end of your piece, you talk about this famous meditation in St. Ignatius's spiritual exercise called 3 Degrees of Humility. And this is something that you reflected upon on your retreats during your formation process. Maybe you can tell our listeners what you learned from that process.
Well, St. Ignatius said that the ultimate degree of humility in life is actually to desire to be treated the same way Christ was treated, is not to be considered a wise man or a rich man, but to be considered kind of a fool, to be treated as, what's the phrase, not wise or prudent in this world. It's interesting the way humility really is an important factor, I think, in a religious vocation, especially if you're joining, as I have found, an order like the Jesuits with a lot of resources, because exactly what you think you're giving away when you take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, in some ways you get those back in the, you know, the phrase from the gospel, the hundredfold. Yes, you're materially poor, but you have the resources of a huge organization. Yes, in chaste life, you've given up marriage, but you become much closer to men and women who are married or single, who wouldn't be so close to you if you were married. And then you're obedient, but you also get to travel and work in all sorts of exotic places. You know, I haven't exactly been hiding away in a monastery for the last 6 years, and I've gotten to do a lot of things I wouldn't have done were I not a Jesuit.
Well, Jim Keane, we'd like to thank you again for coming and talking about this very well done article, Vocation in Crisis, in the February 4th issue. And we'd also like to mention that Jim is one of our bloggers on In All Things, so you can check that out on our homepage to hear more from him. He also recently had a review of the Golden Compass, which is online and one of our most hit upon articles. So, Jim, thanks again, and hopefully you can come back soon.
Thank you, Tim.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. I want to alert you to a couple of interesting things on the web this week, including a profile of Craig Finn of the independent rock band To Hold Steady. Sean Dempsey, a Jesuit from California, reviews that band and their latest album, Girls and Boys in America. That's worth checking out. Also be sure to check out our two blogs, In All Things and The Good Word, which is on scripture and preaching. And, of course, you can subscribe to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.